You have probably heard that animal studies have led to advanced theories about human psychology. The results may be used against you to sell products or even political candidates. Or maybe it will help us understand what parts of our brains we need to solve complex problems like energy addiction or climate change. We're going to hash this out a bit with Dr. Deirdre Barrett. She's a popular writer and also a psychology researcher at Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Deirdre.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, good to have you. And before we start, I'd like to clue listeners a little into your dual interests. Dream study and evolutionary biology seem worlds apart, but you do both. I know you publish specialized scientific research, but can you give us a brief look at your previous popular books?
Well, my first book was on hypnotherapy. It's called The Pregnant Man and Other Cases from a Hypnotherapist's Couch, about clinical work I'd done up until that time. And then The Committee of Sleep is about dreams and creative problem solving. And I have another book called Trauma and Dreams, whose title is obvious. And really the only connection between my interests in imagery via hypnosis and dreams and all and what my most recent two books are about is that theoretically I'm an evolutionary psychologist. I really think it's extremely important to always keep in mind that behavior has to have been adaptive to survival and in primeval settings rather than modern ones. So looking at what we as humans do today in terms of what that would have meant 10,000 years ago on the savannah is a very important way to think about human psychology.
Right. Well, I called you after reading a newspaper article with the unlikely headline, "Latest Info, Don't Trust Your Gut." It was a review of your new book, A Supernormal Stimuli, and I thought right away, well, finally, a bit of light on why we humans continue to make such stupid choices long after we know the facts. Is that part of your book?
Definitely. I mean, I think that cliche that people like to say about, you know, just trust your gut or trust your instincts, listen to your instincts, that those are all really misguided. I mean, sometimes people think that evolutionary theory would suggest that our instincts should be adaptive to our survival, but that would only be true if we were still back in the setting where they evolved. Our instincts have not had any time to catch up to our modern high population density technological setting. So we have these instincts that were designed for hunting and gathering on the savannas of Africa, where all our prehuman ancestors were and the lifestyle that humans were living until just what's the blink of an eye in evolutionary history. So like in terms of food, we're programmed to look for sugar, look for salt, look for fat. We aren't programmed to look strongly for green leafy vegetables because they were all around us and we were busy seeking out the rarer nutrients that we need. And we just, our bodies haven't had time to adjust to the fact that we can suck all the fat and sugar and salt we want out of foods and concentrate them in these chunks of stuff that are really not good for us, but that appeal to our instincts more than what the instincts evolved for.
Could we then start, as your book does, with that intriguing portrait of the Dutch biologist Nico Tinbergen and his sometime sidekick Conrad Lorenz? Can you give us a nutshell view of how Tinbergen's research could help us with modern problems?
Well, the concept that I found most fascinating, and one which has not made it into the popular language as much as like Lorenz's idea of imprinting the image of the little baby geese following him if he, rather than their mother, is in front of them for their formative first few hours. Lots of the concepts have made it into evolutionary psychology and even in just the popular language, but Tinbergen had this concept that he called a supernormal stimulus, which was after he did some animal research trying to illuminate what instincts were coded for in various mainly non-mammal animals, fish and birds and insects. And he did all these experiments, like with birds, he was looking for what was coded for a healthy egg that they needed to sit on, because when they lay more than they can cover with their body, they will select what are the likeliest to hatch. And he found that they were not coded for the gestalt of a healthy ideal egg of their species, that there were just a few key stimulus that made them want to sit on this egg. And for most birds, whatever color the egg was, they liked a more saturated version. If they laid a pale blue egg, they liked a bright day glow blue egg. If they laid a pale brown egg, they liked a deep, rich brown egg. If it had any sort of spots or dappling, even light gray dappling, then they liked big black polka dots. They liked bigger eggs than their real ones. So you could get this little bitty songbird that would lay pale gray-dappled eggs to sit on this just gigantic plaster, day-glow blue dummy egg covered in this these idiotic-looking polka dots. So it would so big it would just slide off and have to hop back on continuously. And he found that almost every instinct was just coded for a few things like this. Once the chick hatched, parent birds preferred feeding a fake baby bird beak on a stick. It didn't even need a body if the dummy beak was wider or redder than the real chick's. And stickleback fish would ignore a real male in their territory, and they're very territorial, if you floated a dummy fish in whose underside was brighter red, even if it was a very unrealistic-looking fish. He could get butterflies to mate with fake cardboard butterflies in preference to a real female if the stripes down the side of the torso were more dramatic than on a real female. So for almost every instinct, there seemed to be just a few key signs that meant ideal mate or healthy offspring, you need to nurture this thing, or, you know, enemy, you need to fight and keep this out of your territory. And he and Lorenz were studying animals all this time, but when I read this research, it just seems so relevant to people that's what my book, Supernormal Stimuli, is doing, is applying Tinbergen's concepts to most of our modern human dilemmas.
But that's all a bit alarming and depressing in a way. I mean, does love really exist in nature? Are we all pre-programmed, just victims of stimuli, no matter how false they are?
I don't think it means that love doesn't exist, that we have, for romantic love, you know, some pretty strong, pretty simple cues for it, or for other sorts of you know, love of children, some pretty simple stimuli that are indicate, you know, I'm cute, I need your help, and that our stuffed animals pull those instincts a little bit as well as our kids. It doesn't mean it's not real, but some of it is awfully simple and can be manipulated awfully easily and powerfully.
Well, Deirdre, there's been a long-standing argument against taking some biological observations into the complexities of human thought and or social organization. And so allow me this train of three quick questions coming to mind. First, I ask myself, have experiments been done with superstimuli in humans? And then I think, well, should they be done at all? And finally, I realize with all the advertising and propaganda and product design, uh-oh, we're living that experiment right now. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, no one has done research on humans under the term supernormal stimulus, the way Tinbergen very carefully constructed different dummy fish to test and different sized plaster eggs to test and different fake cardboard butterflies to test. But yeah, I think that the issue is that animals usually only encounter a supernormal stimulus when an experimenter builds one, that in nature they're very unlikely to encounter an object that pulls their instinct more strongly than the real thing. That's why they haven't died off from these instincts. And in nature they work very well. But with the dawning of our technological ability, we've basically just completely reversed the relationship between instinct and object, and instead of letting our instincts lead us toward natural objects, we've begun to manufacture objects that very specifically cater to instincts. It just feels right to us to make something that tastes as good as possible, or make something that looks as cute as possible, or make pornography, or make romance literature, or make television shows with laugh tracks and smiley faces on them. That, you know, if we can manufacture something that pulls one of our instincts, it feels good, and we don't even question it or think about it the way we do when we're doing the animal experiments, because the animal instincts immediately look sort of peculiar to us if they're directed to the wrong object. But our food instincts heading toward junk food, or sexual instincts, you know, headed toward a printed centerfold page, human instincts just feel normal to us, and we don't question them.
Oh, boy. Well, if you've just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest is Dr. Deirdre Barrett from the Harvard Medical School. We're talking about her new book, Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose, just published by W.W. Norton. So, Deirdre, I guess I'm getting the message here that these supernormal stimuli are being used against us as consumers.
Certainly. I think... advertisers are among the most sophisticated about producing supernormal stimuli, as though are any commercial industry. I mean, our food industry is manufacturing commercial products that are supernormal stimuli for our appetites. Toy companies are manufacturing supernormally cute stimuli. I think that it's not just advertisers, that we rather automatically, once we got the technological ability, started producing these things to cater to our instincts. And we're as pulled toward them as the animals are, although back to your question of whether you can really extrapolate from animals to humans with all of our reasoning process, I do think that's the key to a big difference, that when we recognize that we are essentially sitting on the bright blue polka-dotted egg, we do have the ability to think about that and climb off if we notice it. I mean, that's exactly what our giant brains are for, is to override simple instincts when they're leading us astray, to be able to abstractly process things and come up with more novel behaviors by reasoning. But the first step is recognizing the pull of the instinct and that we are responding to something supernormal that's not good for us. And that's where we're not usually doing that piece of it these days.
We're just not brain-trained to think that way. Well, let's get down to business here, the business of applying what we know to difficult times. You wrote in an email that our instincts about dangers and self-protection are coded for hostile humans or to pick up dangerous animals or maybe some big disaster, but not really for big issues like planetary warming or depletion of our resources. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, yes, all of our instincts to get alarmed, to sense a danger, to feel like we need to take action to defend ourselves, they're all basically coded for threats that would have been there on the African savanna in hunting and gathering days. So whether it's things that we respond to dramatically in the real world, like when leaders start talking about some super enemy halfway around the world who's developed this terrible weapon and we need to wipe them out before they wipe us out, and motivate a war with that kind of language, we're coded for things like dangerous humans, dangerous animals. And you see it in a more comical way in the sort of disaster films and adventure and horror films that get our attention. I mean, the film titles read almost like an inventory of our primal back on the savannah sort of fears. I mean, there are movies like Arachnophobia, Ticks, Empire of the Ants, Rabid, Infested, Killer Rats, Plague, Outbreak Virus, Twister, Backdraft, Tornado, you know, and or if the titles don't have it, the images have these like huge jaws of a shark or huge jaws of a rabid animal or earthquake swallowing up the earth. I mean, anything that was a danger back then is really, really coded into our genes. I mean, any human back in those times who fought tornado, man-eating tiger, people dying of mysterious disease, I don't really care. I mean, those people didn't leave many offspring, so we're coded for those things. But we're not coded for something like the planet is gaining a fraction of a degree in temperature every year. You know, there are no horror films about a large number of the elderly population dying slowly of flu over the course of the winter. These were just not dramatic events that got our attention. So we overrate anything that plays to those primal, bad person, dangerous animal, natural disaster, and we underrate any other sort of dangerous event, no matter how many people it's killing or, you know, or what the long-term prognosis may be. So I think the take-home message for environmentalists is that, first of all, one way around the pull of supernormal stimuli and the lack of pull of some modern problems is just to be very aware of this concept of supernormal stimulus and of inaccuracies in our threat estimates, and to educate people about those kind of natural, you know, don't trust your instincts about what's dangerous. We really need to think that through. But then also, to the extent that if you're going to do advertising campaigns to get people aware of things like global warming, you want to put it in some concrete terms that do try to tie into those things. Some image of your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren who are going to be running out of fuel and freezing or flooded out of their homes by rising ocean heights, or to translate, even if it has to be sort of into the distant future, to something that, you know, is going to happen to you and your loved ones in a very concrete way, that grabs people's attention more powerfully.
And in this world where we're super stimulated by all sorts of online games and many, many sources of information, I guess we need a very strong stimulus to get any kind of attention at all to these issues.
Yes, definitely. And to really use the ones that do. You mentioned online games. It would be nice to have some online games about fighting global warming rather than all about fighting terrorists.
Yeah, and you've said that the scientists may have drifted into dangerous games like the ultimate nuclear bomb instead of more mundane plays like solar or wind power because they find that work stimulating. Is that what you did say?
I think that in addition to having instincts about nurturing and sex and eating and some of those things we obviously think about as drives, that one drive humans have is curiosity and a pull toward intellectual complexity. And I mean, you see, we spend huge amounts of time playing games. I mean, from old-fashioned crossword puzzles and chess to modern, you know, online computer games, things that are intricate play really intrigue human beings. And I think that a lot of our careers and a lot of our science is determined by what's interesting. So what I was writing about in Supernormal Stimuli is that I think that the direction science will most easily go is toward what the complex, intellectually challenging, interesting problems are, and that's part of why splitting the atom got worked out early on, and part of why harnessing solar power and harnessing wind energy hasn't gotten as much time and attention. Part of it is that supernormal stimulus toward threat, and make the bomb was certainly the number one motivation for nuclear energy. But the fact that atomic physics is so inherently interesting to smart people, I think, was another big piece of it. Whereas solar and wind energy are the kind of fancy plumbing. They're kind of simple concepts, and I don't think they grab scientists quite the same way. And again, I think that we have the ability to override those sorts of instinctive pulls and priorities once we really stop and think about them. But recognizing when a supernormal stimulus is running the show is the first step in beginning to question that and redirect some of our resources if we want to.
Right, so I'm kind of coming out of this with three possible defenses. The first, as you say, is to recognize when we're being played. And the second might be if we could use supernormal stimuli for good instead of self-destructive crud. And then the third, and this is perhaps too much even to dream about, is that we emphasize our rational selves and use what rationality we can to save ourselves.
Yes. And I think that we want to get the supernormal stimuli much lessened in our environment. I mean, we're never going to completely abandon technology and not have any of them. But I think that there are, if you're talking about energy and global warming, there are equivalents to things like what we obviously want to do with foods, which is stop having as much junk, artificial concentrations of refined carbohydrates and fats and salt, and go back to eating a much more natural diet, and tax trans fats and not advertise junk food to children, and rearrange our subsidies so that we promote the growing of fresh vegetables, and just shift the kinds of foods that are around us. It becomes a lot easier to eat healthy than if you as an individual have to always reason about, I should be eating the leafy vegetables, I should be ignoring these milkshakes and french fries here. It's just easier when we rearrange the environment. And so similarly, I think in terms of energy consumption and what our energy sources are, that one of the instincts that our automobiles and lots of our devices are playing to is that we're coded for this instinct that sort of says rest when you don't need to be exercising. I mean, on the savannah, there were enough things we had to exercise for. You were going to run away from the predatory animal. You were going to chase the prey that you were after. You had to move around to hunt and gather. You had to build your shelter. But when you weren't doing one of those things, it wasn't a good idea to be using lots of extra energy, and you wanted to rest when you didn't need to do one of those things. But now we have very few physical tasks that we have to do. Work is not very physical. And so our instincts are still saying rest when you don't absolutely need to exercise, and yet most of us are getting not nearly enough exercise for health. So if we can get some of those, quote, labor-saving devices out of our environment, when right now we do not need to be saving physical labor. We need to be exerting ourselves a bit more physically. So not having as many cars, not using them as much, walking more, bicycling more, getting ourselves to use more of our simple muscle power and like I say, less of these labor-saving devices is not a good idea in many cases.
Well, we may have to rearrange our industrial landscape to suit our rather primitive brains. That's one thing I'm getting out of this. And here's the final question as we wrap up, I think. Do you think that humans have the evolutionary equipment to survive the problems of this civilization?
Yes. I think that our very elaborate cortex and our unique ability to reason around instincts, that we have powerful, primitive, simple instincts like any animal, but we also have this program to be able to notice when they're to our detriment and stop and reason out a completely novel line of activity that we aren't programmed for specifically and that we've never practiced before. That other sort of reasoning ability is what can potentially save us from our ecological disastrous problems, from our wars, our weapons, that the way out of any of our really big crises is through our brains and their ability to override simple instincts. But again, sort of noticing and understanding what the problem is the first crucial step there.
Well, I think you've taken a good step with this book, and my thanks to Dr. Deirdre Barrett, author of Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose. It is a rewarding book and a surprisingly easy read given the difficulty of the subject, so that's a sign of a good author. Thank you so much for being with us, Deirdre.
Interesting talking to you.
You too. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. broadcast on 20 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive.